the most radical nationalistic part of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, got its own leader, Stepan Bandera. Severely anti-Semitic and anti-communist, he proclaimed an independent Ukraine in 1941. His German allies frowned upon such an act of self-will, and it landed him in prison for nearly all the Second World War. Not participating in the events physically, Bandera still managed to successfully spread his ideology. Many independent historians estimate that the OUN militia exterminated from 150 to 200,000 Jews on Ukrainian territory occupied by the Germans by the end of 1941. The most notorious and outrageous massacre took place September 29th and 30th, 1941, in Babi Yar, Kiev. All kikes of the city of Kiev and its vicinity must appear on Monday, September 29th, by 8 o'clock in the morning. Bring documents, money, and valuables, and also warm clothing, linen, etc. Any kikes who do not follow this order and are found elsewhere will be shot. 33,771 Jews were killed in this two-day operation of the Nazis and Ukrainian militia. Another outrageous massacre was carried out by the Ukrainian Insurgent Army and the Bandera faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists in German-occupied Polish Volhynia and Eastern Galicia between 1943 and 1944. This genocide of Poles was led by Mykola Lebed. 35,000 to 60,000 people in Volhynia and 25 to 40,000 in eastern Galicia fell victim to this massive ethnic cleansing operation. Sensing the inevitable loss of the German troops, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists gave up on their former ally and began fighting equally against the Germans and the Soviet forces. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. Bandera's bands continued to wage their guerrilla war against the Soviet regime, carrying out bloody raids on Ukrainian villages and towns, and leaving behind chaos and casualties. This war went on until the middle of the 1950s, when the last collaborators were either detained or fled the country. On May 7, 1945, Germany unconditionally surrendered to the Allies. Ukraine remained a part of the Soviet Union. The peace after the Second World War was short-lived. The United States and the Soviet Union, nations who allied together along with England to defeat the Nazis, tragically became foes as the Cold War began. The era of political and military tension between the US and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera, himself. According to an OSS report of September 1945, Bandera had earned a fierce reputation for conducting a reign of terror during World War II. After the Second World War, Bandera and other Ukrainian Nazi leaders fled to Europe, where the CIA helped them hide. The CIA later informed the Immigration and Naturalization Service that it had concealed Stepan Bandera and other Ukrainians from the Soviets. the operations involving Ukrainians continued for many years. The Nuremberg trials of 1945 and 1946 brought the political, economic, and military leaders of fascist Germany to justice and revealed to the world the monstrous face of Nazism and the crimes they committed. But the Ukrainian Nazis were spared the same fate, and some were even granted indulgences by the CIA. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. Perhaps Bandera lost his use to the U.S., or maybe KGB agents outsmarted the CIA. But in 1959, Stepan Bandera, the leader of the Ukrainian nationalists, was killed in Munich, where he was hiding under the name of Stefan Popel. It would be fair to say that Bandera became a major symbol of Ukrainian nationalism by sheer chance, for he was neither its only leader nor its most powerful one. Dmytro Dontsov was the father of the far-right totalitarian doctrine in Ukraine. Andriy Melnyk was the leader of another faction of the OUN. Roman Shuhevich was a general of the Ukrainian insurgent army, and others contributed greatly to the movement. Bandera's dangerous ideology, suppressed by the communist authorities, but supported by external forces, never really died. The seeds of Ukrainian nationalism were passed from generation to generation. Unfortunately, it was just a matter of time before they would once again blossom. In 1954, Ukraine's territory was expanded even more when Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the USSR, and a Ukrainian himself, generously gave the Crimean region to Ukraine. Historians would argue about the legitimacy of this transfer for many years to come, and 60 years after Khrushchev's gift, dramatic new events would take place in Crimea.
The eyes of the world are on Ukraine as the crisis in Crimea continues.
Dozens of heavily armed men seized government buildings in Crimea.
Should Ukraine just shrug its shoulders and say, okay, Crimea, it's lost?
And the old arguments would heat up once again. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. In Ukraine, a nationalistic political organization, Narodny Rukh, or People's Movement, emerged in 1989 due to this new openness. They advocated for independence of Ukraine from the USSR and became an incubator for leaders of Ukrainian neo-Nazism. In 1991, one of them, Oleg Tyagnibok, founded Svoboda, an openly radical nationalist party preaching the good old principles of Bandera. Purge Ukraine from the Jews and Russians, Ukraine for Ukrainians, and so on. His statements got him fifth place in the Simon Wiesenthal Center Top 10 Anti-Semitic World Leader Rankings of 2012, but also, sadly, attracted numerous followers. Dmitry Yarosh founded another extreme right organization, TRIZU, or Trident, in 1994. In April 2013, Yarosh became an assistant to a member of parliament from the opposition party UDAR. Later that same year, he would become the leader of the most radical Ukrainian Nazi group, the Right Sector. Andriy Paruby would soon appear leading a whole army of ultra-nationalist warriors. And the torch marches, would once again light up the streets of Ukrainian cities. The world drastically changed in August 1991, when the USSR de facto ceased to exist and the global political map welcomed many newcomers, Ukraine one of them. In modern history, it was the first time Ukraine was truly independent and all on its own.
The red flag came down over the Kremlin tonight as President Gorbachev resigned and brought to an end 7 decades of communist rule in the Soviet Union.
The years after the disintegration of the USSR became known as the Crazy 90s in all the post-Soviet territories.
He's leaving behind 15 independent states which share only a disastrous economy and an uncertain future.
After having been under a government-controlled economy, the free market dramatically changed the rules of the game. New businesses emerged instantly, and the first oligarchs were born overnight. The former country with no class division suddenly became stratified. The chosen few became rich, while the rest had to fight to survive. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before. The color revolutions.
Demonstrators clash with police, hundreds of thousands protesting the results of the election and calling for a new vote.
Ukraine has had 2 color revolutions in its 24 years of independence. In 2004, crowds of people descended upon Kiev, marking the start of the Orange Revolution. At that time, Ukraine became once again a battlefield of 2 forces, the Russian and Western governments. The culmination of this conflict took place during the presidential elections in November of 2004. The 2 major candidates, Western-backed Viktor Yushchenko and Russian-leaning Viktor Yanukovych, almost equally shared the votes of Ukrainians. By the way, calling Viktor Yushchenko Western-backed is not an exaggeration. His wife, Katerina Yushchenko, is a former U.S. State Department official and worked in the White House during the Reagan administration. The division was along geographic lines. Traditionally, Russian Eastern Ukraine voted for Yanukovych, while Western Ukraine chose Yushchenko. By the announced result, Viktor Yushchenko lost to Viktor Yanukovych, but thousands of people didn't agree with it, and they came to the central square of Kiev on the 22nd of November. The situation received wide news coverage.
The country's election commission ignored reports of fraud, declaring Kremlin-backed Viktor Yanukovych the winner.
International politicians, such as former General Secretary of NATO, Javier Solana, became frequent guests in Kiev, initiating negotiations between parties.
And I hope very much that the goodwill of everybody will be able to overcome this difficulty.
The results of the negotiations, however, were often reached only on paper. Thus, Yushchenko never told the supporters to stop blocking government buildings in central Kiev. Therefore, these non-violent and very orange protests lasted for a month, during which time the previous election results were annulled, marred by massive corruption, and new elections were announced. An important nuance: just 3 months before, Viktor Yushchenko became a victim to a mysterious and still unsolved poisoning. But it didn't prevent him from winning in the new election. Though, as we shall soon see, there was much more than just the people's will that led to this victory. This peaceful revolution and its leader were warmly welcomed by the international community. But the euphoria didn't last long. Yushchenko's government completely failed with reforms and lost its chance to establish democracy, instead descending into infighting. Viktor Yushchenko was not re-elected for a second term, but at the end of his presidency, he had the time to make one last gift to his supporters from Western Ukraine. The hero status of Stepan Bandera was short-lived. In 2010, Viktor Yanukovych was elected president. This time, the international community had no doubts about the legitimacy of the elections. In January 2011, Viktor Yanukovych repealed the hero title of Bandera. Almost 4 years into his presidency, though, another revolution shook Ukraine. Unfortunately, this one was anything but peaceful.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on RIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a question related to the beginning of the last surah of the Holy Quran, Surah An-Nas. As you know, in this surah, if you've had the time to glance over this surah and its contents, you know that in the beginning of the surah, God Almighty refers to himself using three attributes, three sifats, three of his divine attributes and beautiful names. First is Rabbin Nas, the Lord of men. Second is Malikin Nas, the sovereign and the king of men. And the third is Ilahin Nas, the object of worship of men, the Lord of men. Right, so today we're going to be examining why is it that God Almighty has referred to himself using these three attributes. And also a second question, which is kind of tied up to the first, is why is it that he has mentioned these three verses without a conjunction, meaning without a wall? Usually, like some of the verses of the Holy Quran, right, one verse is connected to the previous verse by means of a conjunction, for example, and, right? Or in Arabic, we say wal. In other words, why did God not say, قُلْ أَعُوذُ بِرَبِّ النَّاسِ وَمَلِكِ النَّاسِ وَإِلَهِ النَّاسِ? Seek refuge in the Lord of men and the King of men and in the God of men, or the object of worship of men. Right. So regarding the first question, we can say that the reason why God Almighty has referred to himself using these three attributes is that these three attributes, right, are the reason why we should seek refuge in him. Right. Right. Sometimes in the Holy Quran and also in Arabic, right, an attribute is mentioned for the subject of a ruling, which is in reality the reason for the ruling itself, right? So in the context of what we're talking about, the reason why we should seek refuge in God is because he is the Lord of men. He sustains men. He is the sovereign and king of men, meaning he has the power to take care of us and repel this danger from us, as well as because he is the object of worship of men. These three attributes are the reason and the cause for why God deserves to be the object and the being in which we seek refuge from this danger. Regarding the second question, which was, why is it that these three verses have not been connected using a conjunction or a wow or the word and, we can say that the reason for this possibly is because, according to some Quranic commentators, is because each of these three attributes is an independent, can serve as an independent and separate reason for the ruling or why we should seek refuge in God. I mean, even if God didn't have any other attribute besides the fact that he was the object of worship of men, we should seek refuge in him. Even if he didn't have any other attribute besides the fact that he is the sovereign and the person who governs and he has the power over all beings in this universe, we should still seek refuge in him. Okay? Or even if you know he didn't have any other attribute except for the fact that he was the Lord of men, we should seek refuge in him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the first three verses of Surah An-Nas. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take firearms industry and other military-industrial complex big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame, says F. Douglas Stephenson, researcher, in an article published under the heading Gun maker profits soar as bloody massacres proliferate in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. U.S. citizens are waking up to the fact that so many politicians can be so easily bought by the weapons industry, an industry that doesn't care how many people must die to protect their huge profits. SafeHome.org reports that after a record year in 2020, gun sales in the U.S. dipped slightly in 2021. Still, with nearly 19 million guns sold, 2021 was the second highest year for gun sales in the U.S., behind only 2020, when estimated gun sales topped 21 million. The previous record year was 2016, with about 16 million guns sold. Total estimated gun sales fell 13% between 2020 and 2021, but they remained higher than they were in 2019, up nearly 40%. The large number of weapons in the United States of America is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. The total number of guns sold in 2021 is more than double the number sold in 2001. In fact, sales in the U.S. rose by about 155% between 2002 and 2021. No state had more gun sales in 2021 than Texas, where an estimated 1.6 million firearms were sold in the nation's second largest state. Florida followed closely with 1.4 million firearms sold. DearLord.com reported that weapons makers Roger and Winchester both had profit spikes in recent earnings filings. Their latest 2021 quarters topped record sales the companies had experienced even during the height of 2020 gun sales surge. The numbers come after July 2021 came in as the second best July on record for FBI background checks on gun sales. Roger reported its net sales in the first 6 months of 2021 were up over $130 million or 51% over the same time last year. The company did nearly $200 million in firearm sales alone between April and June. That represents a 54% increase over the same period in 2020, even though the onset of the coronavirus pandemic and rioting drove Americans to gun stores at record rates during that time period. Similarly, Winchester reported the first 6 months of 2021 produced a $412 million or 108% increase in sales. The gun and ammo makers' sales increased even further by 110% when looking at the April to June period. Winchester's parent company, Olin Corporation, saw net income climb from a $120 million loss in the April to June period of 2020 to a $355 million profit in 2021. They went from a $220 million loss in the January to June 2020 period to a $599 million profit in 2021. In spite of the above numbers, many citizens are also realizing that the idea of the Second Amendment guaranteeing the right of individual gun ownership is radical and wrong and was never intended by the founders to be a barrier to establishing a stringent weapon safety and control laws for the U.S. community. Turning gun violence into a mental health problem is incorrect, dangerous, and irresponsible, as anyone with even minimal knowledge of mental health issues knows. It's of course true people who kill children en masse are crazy, but asserting this reality says nothing. All countries have mentally ill and violent people, but U.S. citizens are increasingly more aware that only the United States of America arms them. Although the U.S. public is demanding real changes for much better safety in weapons regulation, the toxic results of U.S. current lack of adequate weapons control policies continues its deadly pace. The United States of America cannot any longer allow the profiteering military-industrial complex and their beholden politicians to get away with hiding or changing the subject, hoping the public forgets about the problem until the next mass shooting. By using denial over many years to reject and avoid the need for stringent gun control legislation, the GOP and some Democrats have fallen into a miasma of self-induced indifference and dangerous permissiveness toward gun ownership and its deadly consequences. The large number of weapons in the U.S. is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. This is why resistance to legislative proposals to better gun control culture and gun violence itself seem to many gun owners as attacks on their own personality and national identity. The bigger, more powerful the weapon, the more powerful the gun owner feels. Many marginalized and enraged lone wolf murderers, thanks to easy access to assault-style weapons, can misuse Second Amendment gun rights to cleanse the world. 21st century U.S. culture still venerates violence with the U.S. myth of heroic frontier psychology, but at the very high cost of crippling and killing American children. Historian Roxanne Dunbar Oritz, in her book Loaded, A Disarming History of Second Amendment, gives alarming statistics about weapons and gun deaths in the United States of America. There are 310 million firearms in the United States, 114 million handguns, 110 million rifles, and 86 million shotguns. The number of military-style assault weapons in private hands, including AR-15 semi-automatic rifles used in the massacres at Majority Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, is estimated at 1.5 million. The United States has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, an average of 90 firearms per 100 people. The total gun deaths in the United States of America average around 37,000 a year, with two-thirds of those deaths being suicides, leaving approximately 12,000 homicides, 1,000 of those at the hands of the police. Mass shootings, ones that leave four or more people wounded or dead, now occur in the United States on average at the pace of one or more per day. Disturbing as that fact is, mass shootings currently account for only 2% of gun killings annually. And the number of gun deaths, 37,000, is roughly equal to deaths by vehicle incidents in the United States per year. The Second Amendment, written by James Madison and adopted in 1791, says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Although generations of activists, gun owners, and jurists have disagreed about how this should be interpreted in a modernizing world, what has been recognized is what the Second Amendment was really to be used for. History professor Roxanne Dunbar Oritz documents in Loaded, a disarming history of the Second Amendment, the purpose of armed militias of the Second Amendment. The kind of militias and gun rights of the Second Amendment had long existed in the 13 British colonies and were expected to continue fulfilling two primary roles in the new United States. Number one, destroying native communities in the armed march to possess the continent. And number two, brutally subjecting the enslaved African population. Dunbar Oritz demonstrates that the violence sanctioned by the Second Amendment was a key factor in transforming America into a militaristic business powerhouse. As the fledgling nation embarked on its relentless westward expansion in the 19th century, the labor of powerful, meanwhile, America's gun culture was growing in tandem with the country's increasingly sophisticated publishing and firearms manufacturing industries. Pulp novels romanticized ex-Confederate soldiers and rifle-wielding frontiersmen. Brand name weapons acquired a special status. In the two decades after the Civil War, Dunbar Oritz writes, the Winchester rifle was fetishized for killing Indians, and the Colt revival for outlawry. In the process, gun violence and civilian massacres were not just normalized, but commercially glorified, packaged, promoted, and mass marketed. In 21st century America, fantasy and myth about frontier psychology still continue being played out by Hollywood, video internet games, and other manufactured fantasies that promote weapon sales. Just as communities today rely on professional public health experts in epidemiology to control the incidence, distribution, and control of disease, in any population, so too for public safety and health, we should rely on experts in weapons control and distribution to advise and design adequate, stringent legislation for community weapons control or regulation. The profile of a gun safety program could include, number one, prior to approving access to any weapon, potential weapon owners should be required to get formal instruction and pass a rigorous background check. Number two, an annual inspection by law enforcement authorities on how ammunition and weapons are stored, plus full inspection of weapons themselves, should be conducted. Number three, banned weapons should be collected by law enforcement as well. And number four, reimbursement, if any, for banned firearms would be the responsibility of the taxpayer and should be considered an investment in public safety. After mass shootings, many have or will use an amateur or banal analysis of the psychology of killers to provide much-needed camouflage for the profiteering military gun industrial complex NRA. Declare that it is a mental health, behavioral health problem, all in the killer's mind, and perhaps we won't notice that. Pathetic U.S. state local non-controlled weapons policy results in amazingly high murder rates, suicides, and frequent mass murders. When deranged people have such remarkably easy access to arsenals of weapons, every so often one of them will go ballistic. We can't eliminate all political, religious extremism, or mental illness, but we can most certainly prevent people from having access to rapid-fire semi-automatic weapons and thousands rounds of ammo. The UK has 1/6 Americans' murder rate, not because they are psychologically healthier or nicer than the United States of America. The UK and many other countries just don't have or allow the weaponry hardware to be available to do as much damage. Thousands of prayers and thoughts are of little value unless Americans accept the fact that their laws reducing access to weapons need to be greatly strengthened, not loosened. Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take NRA, firearms industry, and other military-industrial complex, big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers, thoughts, and condolences for dead children, grieving parents, and disrupted communities are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame for their preposterous and irresponsible scapegoating of the mentally ill, while letting politicians, devotees of loose access laws, and the profiteering gun industry itself continue to squirm out of any responsibility.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio today our speaker, Sister Razia Batul Najafi. She's an Islamic researcher, and I have had this pleasure to sit with her in the studio today. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam, rahmatullah.
How
are
you?
Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, I always have this good feeling to be with you. Thank you so much for coming. Sister Najafi, we discussed in the previous episodes the responsibilities that parents had towards their kids. That was the, you said, giving them a better name, providing better environment for their education. And you said education was not only a secular one, it was the Islamic education as well, the marriage and being friends with them. And then we said in other sessions, in the following session, we said that not just parents, but society, school, a guide, a spiritual guide also plays a role in the upbringing. Well, today I want to discuss a very important question with you, which many listeners had. I'm just summing up that question in one line. That is, in Islamic perspective, what time does the upbringing of a child start? Does it start after a child is born, or does it start somewhere before that?
When we are choosing our life partner, yeah, so I really want our listeners to pay attention of this word of life partner, life. You know, your life is going to start and you have some vision in your life and you want someone as a helper to pursue your vision in your life. So life partner means what? Means if you are having, inshallah, some child, yeah, children, so you need that partner to help you to bring, you know, bring up that upbringing of that children. So life partner means my vision is to leave a good progeny, yeah?
All right.
Beautiful children. Mm-hmm. And then, inshallah, I'll go to my destination. So for having that baqiyat al-salihat, that beautiful children, I need a partner. So I'm choosing that
himself.
One.
Who's beautiful himself.
Yeah.
Who's beautiful himself.
Exactly. So I don't know why the media, the movies, the dramas, you know, they're always looking for someone who's handsome or gorgeous. No. Handsome, not only physically, but when you think of your marriage, life partner, you straight away, hadith says, think of your future, your children. Like me, for example, if I really want to have a daughter-in-law, for example, for my son. So I'm thinking, oh, my daughter-in-law, yeah, or my son should think that, oh, because in her arms, my generation going to train.
True.
So what kind of mindset she would have or
yeah.
he would have, you know? How much pure she or he has. So automatically, if I'm pure, if I'm a calm person, if I'm a positive person, so my child will get that beauty the way she or he get the physical beauty the same way, you know.
He needs the spiritual beauty as well. He needs the
beauty. But unfortunately, we say, oh yeah, you know, like someone smart, handsome, you know, just physical
good
perfections
looks.
Are our priorities.
Yeah.
But not inner qualities. So when you are looking for your partner, that means you are looking for your generation.
Children, your generation, basically.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's great. I would love to discuss that with you. We need to take a short break, dear listeners. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I have with me Sister Najafi, and we are talking about the time of upbringing. What time does the upbringing of a child start in Islamic perspective? Sister Najafi, you said the actual time is not when a child is born and then the upbringing starts. The upbringing starts actually when you meet your partner.
Exactly.
So you said that we, when we are looking at a partner, we look at the physical beauty, we look at the looks that are main priority, we look at the richness, we look at the material, we look at whatever he has materially, and we really don't look at the etiquettes or the morals, the values the person has, because those values, you said, are going to transmit into the offsprings.
Yes. I usually say that, you know, to my students that you have to marry with someone who's really rich and really handsome. Richness in faith, yeah?
All right.
And handsome means husn, and that beauty in akhlaq, in etiquette, in morals. And if someone says that, yeah, your partner is, mashallah, perfect, but maybe he cannot live or she cannot live more than 2-3 years because of certain some diseases. So you'll not go with that partner, yeah? So the same way, our partner, you know, I will say not only for this world, we have to think for hereafter. So according to hadith, that if I'm choosing the best partner, yeah, the more pious than me.
All right.
Then on the day of judgment, that partner, not only he's having that right of intercession for me, even for my children. So me and my children can get promotion forever because of my good partner. But
all right,
good means indefinitely, you know, in high rank of akhlaq and manners and definitely faith and, you know, piety. So sometimes I say this is the best way, the easiest way to go to Jannah, to have a good, you know, partner in especially
right,
in faith, you know, because you will get the way if you marry someone
you're getting
very
a free
rich,
ticket.
Yeah. If someone is very rich, you know, automatically you get all the facilities, you know, in this dunya.
Yeah.
So if someone is really rich in iman, in faith, so, you know, most probably you will get all those beautiful, you know, spiritual environment because of your partner, because you have
you're actually getting a free ticket to the trip of heaven forever.
Exactly. Yeah. That is a beautiful way to say, yeah.
Yeah. I'll be talking to you, sister. We need to take another short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We are talking about a perfect time of upbringing. When does the perfect time of upbringing start? In Islamic perspective, Sister Najafi, you said it starts from the very moment we start choosing our partner. And in terms of while we're choosing our partner, we are actually choosing a future generation. I know a mother who was really concerned while she was getting her daughter married. She was saying, I am marrying my daughter right now, but I am feeling so guilty that I never gave her some materialistic luxuries in her life. I feel very guilty that she does not have much, you know, dowry with her to take to another home. And I heard some beautiful man telling her, did you give her the idea of 5 times praying in a day? And the mother was like, Yes, my daughter offers 5 times prayers. Did you give her iman? And the mother was like, yes, of course, she's full of iman. And the person was saying, you reminded me of the story with your discussion. And the man was like, then you have given her the tremendous dowry with her that she needs to take. So I want you to tell our listeners, what kind of dowry should parents actually give to their daughters that she will take to another home, that she will carry on for the future generations?
Beautifully you have explained, mashallah. I love your style and the selection of wordings, mashallah. Yeah, I would say not only, whenever we talk about the marriage and we say, oh yeah, the new life is going to start, now everything should be new. I say, yeah, this is also a big level, because after marriage life is definitely a big change comes in our life and we start a new life. But the faith and the beautiful akhlaq and manners and connection to Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, whatever dowries mother is giving to her children, that is not only for this life, even for that life, that the actual life.
Right.
So I don't know how to say the richest, the most inner peace state, which is the most expensive level of luxury life, inner life. If you see, that is the luxurious life, that someone is satisfied, someone is happy, someone is content, someone is, having a beautiful vision in the life.
That sukoon, that satisfaction, you want to
inner
say.
Peace, yeah.
Yeah.
So you feel, wow, look at her or look at him,
Yeah.
Oh, I wish I was in place of this person. So that kind of dowry, no one can steal it, no one can snatch it, no one can take it. That is eternal.
And it will never finish.
Yeah, never ever finish. Yeah. Yeah,
because the dowry we take in this world, the material things that we take in this world are going to finish at one point of time. And then we are again going to listen what she got with her. Nothing. We have these claims from the mother-in-laws and other in-laws who wait for the materialistic dowry. So you said the most important thing that a mother can give to her daughter, a young daughter, is in terms of dowry, is the richness in iman, is the 5 times prayers, is the fasting
beauty
thing.
Beauty of akhlaq.
Beauty of values that she's going to transmit into the future generations.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, Sister Najafi, thank you so much for being with us.
Welcome.
It was a great discussion with you. I always love to discuss with you. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. For any suggestions, for any questions, for any feedback, please email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Our website is parstoday.com, wherein you can find all our programs. Going to the option Call of Islam and you'll find our programs. Until another episode, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio,
Coming up is the news.